Professor Dr. Walter Longo, visionary pioneer committed to cancer research, is the director of the cancer program at the IFM Institute of Molecular Oncology in Milan. He has been awarded for his discoveries by the Nathan Schock Lecture Award and by the American Federation for Aging Research. Dr. Longo has dedicated his life to studying the relationship between diet and cancer. Today, he is my special guest in Como Curar. Before we dive in, I have a small favor to ask. If you find value in my episodes, please hit that subscribe button. It is a simple way to support us and it helps our community grow so we can reach and help more people just like you. Thank you for being here and for all of your support. And now let's get started in another episode. Dr. Professor Walter Longo, such a pleasure to have you here all the way from Italy. Thanks for giving us the time. You're a researcher. You've been devoting your life to longevity and cancer for over 20 years. What made you be interested, first of all, on researching longevity and cancer through nutrition?
Well, essentially, we were seeing that these organisms which we were studying, they had mutations, like cancer cells have mutations, and they were not able to become protected in response to fasting. So you fast, and most organisms become protected. But the cancer cells, no matter where they came from, they could never become protected. So that's where we started, because I thought that this maybe is the way, one of the very few ways, if not the only way, to distinguish all the cancer cells from all the normal cells, right? So you fast a person, and then the normal cells will become protected. They go one way, and the cancer cells, they go crazy. They try to keep dividing, and they die, right? Because they're not supposed to do that.
There is one food category that has been linked to these cells actually dividing and reproducing. What would you say is the one food, if somebody's watching this and they have cancer or they're in treatment, is there one specific food that you would tell them right away to stop consuming?
I think that probably high protein diets, animal protein diets, right? So we're bombarded with animal proteins commercials. And I think most people around the world are now eating lots of proteins from all kinds of sources. And those we know, it's very clearly mice, but we also have data from humans suggesting that these animal proteins can help the cancer grow and also help the cancer survive. So you cannot eliminate it, right? So the idea is not to eliminate proteins, but to put it right in the low level that is sufficient to be healthy, to have muscle, but not to help the cancer cell grow and survive.
You made a really good point, because there is a little bit of a controversy nowadays with protein consumption. Some say that you need 0.8 grams per kilo of body weight to maintain your muscles. Others say that that's barely to survive, that if we build muscle or we want to build muscle and be strong, especially as we age, we should be consuming twice as much. What's your take when it comes to longevity and prevention? Where should be the number? Because it's impossible to be perfect, but we want to be as close to what's healthy for us as we can.
Well, first of all, I should say that I started nonprofit clinics in the United States, Italy, and now we're trying to also do that in Spain and elsewhere. And they're there to help people, even people that cannot afford it, because it's very complicated. I mean, I could try to put it in a few words, but it's very complicated. So yeah, proteins are one of the complications. And I think the 0.8 is a good number, and especially for a cancer patient. Now, it's also a simplification, an oversimplification, because if somebody's 16 and growing, 0.8 is not enough, right? But and somebody's 89 and deficient, 0.8 may also not be enough. But if somebody has cancer, is high risk for cancer, 0.8, mostly plant-based proteins, is the way to go. So you see that even if I try to summarize the answer, the minimal I have to do is what I just said.
you have actually summarized it very elegantly. So if somebody is young and is growing, may need a larger amount of protein per kilo of body weight. If a woman is young, has no traces of cancer, is healthy, is metabolically flexible, exercises, maybe will need a little bit more than that. But if a patient has cancer, consuming too much protein can be a problem. Did I get that right?
Yeah. So older people may need more. The young woman doesn't really need more. 0.8 is very good. It needs a balance of animal, let's say fish plus plant in that 0.8. Because if it's all, let's say, legumes, if it's all beans and peas, then they're going to be deficient, right? But if it's a good, let's say, 2 out of 3 meals or plant and 1 out of 3 is fish or so, or let's say health and health, then they should be fine. I mean, between, let's say, age 20 and age 65, 70, the 0.8 mix of plant and animal. Now, for the people that are vegan, you can do seeds and nuts and legumes, right? So, and they have different amino acid profile, and those allow for the right amount of the right amino acid to be available.
Additionally, from protein, what's your opinion on sugar? We know that one of the first tests that a patient, if we're suspicious of a patient having cancer, is an injection is applied, which is then put under a fluorescent light or system to see where the cancer cells possibly are. And that's done with sugar. What is your perception of sugar? Do you think sugar is a culprit, can be a food that we should control or reduce?
Yeah, so one of the tasks of the medical and nutrition team at the Create Cures Foundation is to keep the sugar low but not too low, right? So they, in cancer patients, right? So we want to keep it low, maybe around 65, 70 fasting glucose, but not too low, because otherwise now the may start negatively affecting the immune system, right? So the immune cells need sugar too. And if you start starving the immune cells too much, then the system now the immune cells are the most important body cell against the cancer. So if they're weakened, now you have a problem. So again, you got to keep the sugar fairly low, but keep the patient nourished, and to make sure that only the cancer cells are suffering.
But a glucose level of 60, 65 is a relatively low when we think that 90 is what's considered normal. Do we need to consume sugar as a food in order to maintain that glucose level of 60, 65? Or that level we will naturally be produced by the body with a different type of nourishing food consumption?
Yeah, the body is set to make sugar when the sugar is too low by gluconeogenesis, right? So then the way to do it is pretty tricky, and every patient is different, right? So we use what I call the longevity diet, which is actually the title of my first book, and then the fasting mimicking diet, right? So we use a combination of these two to try to drive the fasting glucose to those low but sufficient levels. And so once we get to around 70, we like that 65, 70, then that's on one side. And the other side, we want to keep what's called IGF-1, this growth factor, fairly low, but again, not too low, around 100 to 130, 40. And so those are the insulin also we want to keep low. So we want to keep low insulin, low glucose, low IGF-1, but none of those should be too low.
So when we say low, what are we looking at for a normal A1C for a patient to be healthy? Not necessarily for somebody to have cancer, but actually, as you speak in your book, longevity is about prevention, about being healthy, not to get sick. It's easier not to have to solve a cancer problem if we have been successful and not developing it. So what are we looking at a healthy A1C and a healthy insulin percentage for a woman or for a man?
Yeah, so A1C should probably be below 5, right? So that's what we usually go for. Now, somebody doesn't have cancer, is not at risk for cancer, it could be a little bit higher. That's okay. That's probably not a big deal. But if somebody has cancer or has had cancer recently, then probably trying to keep it below 5 is important. But again, it cannot become malnourished and then have it too far below, because now it's gonna be worse than keeping high sugar.
And when we talk about insulin, so that would be A1C. What are you looking for a healthy patient, on insulin levels?
Yes, insulin levels, I'll have to look back and what the range is that we try to get them to, but fairly low, right? But it doesn't matter, because once you get the sugar to be that low, the insulin is going to follow, right? So once if a patient has an A1C below 5, that's all they have to worry about. The insulin is going to be low.
Now, as we are looking at longevity and we're looking at health, not necessarily just cancer, and you're a cancer researcher, and we're very proud of you because you're really bringing a lot of information and breaking a lot of dogmas that we had for many years about cancer prevention and cancer cure and things that we can do additionally from the normal therapies. But when we are thinking on this new lifestyle that is becoming popular, fasting, you develop something that is called mimic fasting. Is that better than the popular 16A, 24-hour fasting? What is the mimic fasting?
Yeah, the fasting mimicking diet, or FMD, is very different from this daily intervention like 16-8 or 5-2. And the idea is more of a medicine, right? So it comes in a box. It's a plant-based 5 days, and it's clinically tested for lots of different diseases and problems, including cancer. And so the idea is to bring, especially for the cancer, but also for diabetes and for cardiovascular disease, et cetera, to bring to the doctor a real option, right? So not just the doctor, but also the patient, right? So there is a version that people could do. And by the way, I donate everything to charity, so I don't make a penny out of any of this. But so there is a version that is, the idea is to prevent diseases. And then there are versions that we've been testing for, let's say, Alzheimer's, cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. Why are they different? Well, they're lasting 5 days, and they have the job to let the patient eat. Most people cannot go water-only fasting for more than a few hours. So then the idea is to feed the patients or the people with regular meals that are plant-based, but they're designed in a way that they trick the body into responding as if nothing was eaten at all, right? So that's why they're fasting mimicking diet. They're like fasting-like. And so they work very well, right? So now we have maybe over 10 clinical trials in cancer. For example, in Holland, in a multi-center trial by University of Leiden, they showed that the patients that were doing chemotherapy, the women with breast cancer that were doing chemotherapy together with the fasting mimicking diet, if they did it every cycle, they were 5 times less likely to be resistant to the chemotherapy, right? So they responded 5 times better, if you will, to the chemotherapy. So yes, I think that the fasting mimicking diet is very, very different from this daily fasting. I mean, there's nothing wrong with 12 hours of daily fasting. I'm not a big fan of the 16 hours, but I like this time restricted eating for, let's say, eat for 11, 12 hours a day. That's a very good way to go. The work by Sachin Panda and other. And so I think that for healthy people, I recommend these two. But also for cancer patients, I recommend these two, right? So the fasting mimicking diet, the standard of care, whether it's chemo, immunotherapy, kinase inhibitors, hormone therapy, et cetera. And then they, you know, fast for about 13 hours a day. I mean, 12 hours a day for normal people, maybe 13, 14 hours a day for people with cancer. There's data suggesting that people that do that, they do better.
So you say that you don't like the 16-8. What don't you like about it? What's the biological impact? Do you see an imbalance that occurs?
Well, most of the 16-hour studies have patients skip breakfast, right? So they have dinner and then they skip breakfast, and that's how they get to 16 hours. Now, if you look at meta-analysis, so studies of all studies with skip breakfast, they're consistently negative, right? So people that skip breakfast have higher cardiovascular disease. They have higher mortality. Some studies also suggest higher cancer. And so, and recently, there were several articles that came out that show that just by starting the meals at 4 hours later, right? Instead, if you eat, the patients were brought into the hospitals and they were given exactly the same amount of food. But the food either started at 12 or started at 8. And those that started at 8, they did much better for hunger and for energy expenditure, meaning that the metabolism slows if you start your eating day later and the hunger goes up, right? So this may be a mechanism explaining what we have known for a while from this all these studies showing that people that skip breakfast live shorter. And so then that's why I'm very much against the 16-8, unless you do it for a short period to get, say, a few months, you need to, get to the next level. And then, and I recommend, of course, the longevity diet, the 12-hour time restricted eating, and then the fasting mimicking diet cycles, maybe 3 times a year for a normal person.
So when you say have breakfast, do you need in that breakfast? Can that breakfast be something like most people like having coffee? Having coffee with something that has higher calorie intake, like instead of milk, cream, that would give more calories, maybe some MCT oil. Could that be considered a breakfast for some people, or we need to include carbohydrates and proteins?
I think we don't know, first of all, but the science indicates that maybe you need to have maybe 300 or so calories at least, right? So you cannot just put cream in the coffee. That doesn't count as breakfast. So yeah, I have, let's say, 300 calories. And then, there are now things that we're working on, for example, on addressing that, right? Is there like a bar? There's one that is being clinically tested, and there's like bars that simulate fasting that allow patients or people to eat and continue to have the effect of the 16-8 if somebody wants to do the 16-8. So that may be like a compromise, let's say, right? I still don't like it, but I think that could be a compromise. But otherwise, I think I'm a big fan of skipping lunch. I've been doing it for 20 years. And I know of no negative, so I replace lunch with a small snack. And I know of no negative effects of skipping lunch. But, this is not being clinically extensively tested. So we don't know what the long-term consequences of that would be either.
When we're looking at overall health, we both agree that the higher calorie intake worldwide, everybody's eating more often and more of everything. So if a normal body needs a specific amount of calories, most people consume more. And that's why we have an obesity epidemic. What would be the ideal ratio that you're looking for? Are you looking for, now I'm talking about a healthy patient, not necessarily a patient with cancer, but somebody that wants to remain healthy. Are you looking for a specific ratio, carbohydrates, protein, fat? And are you looking for a total calorie intake that will not surpass a certain amount of calories?
Yeah, so the ratio it should be about 50-60% carbohydrates, keeping the starches, the pasta, the bread, the rice, the potatoes low, and keeping the sugars low. About half of your calories should come from carbohydrates. And there's many, many studies looking at not only weight, but longevity, suggesting that it's better to have an 80% carbohydrate diet than to have a very low carbohydrate diet. But 50% is a good compromise. Yeah, then the rest of it should be maybe around 35% or so in fats, plant-based fats. So olive oil, the nuts, the walnuts, etc., and the salmons, etc. And then the rest of it, proteins, mostly plant-based or what we already discussed earlier. Now, calories are really relevant. It's really should be about BMI, body mass index, and waist circumference, right? So if somebody has the right fat, let's say, level and the right weight, then they're fine with whatever calorie intake. So somebody could have twice as much calories as somebody else, or somebody could have half of the calories and do terrible. So I think it's a BMI, and it looks like women around 21 or so maybe a good way to be for health. I know women want to be thinner, but I think if you look at health, you know, 21 for women and about 23 for men seem to be sort of the perfect body mass index. So, but women, you know, probably going as far as down as 19 are probably okay. Men don't seem to be doing very well if they go much lower than 22, let's say.
So all these bodybuilders that they go down to 5-7% body fat, do you consider that healthy? Because their BMI changes as well. They're very muscular. Is that healthy, or is that just somebody that looks really good but not necessarily reflecting health?
It's probably not healthy, right? So it's probably pushing it over the limit. And so now you're entering a territory that is unknown, right? It could be good for you. It could be terrible for you. So we don't know. We have lots and lots of data in, you know, maintaining the fat percentage low, but not too low, not that low. We have, and we have that data also for older people. And it turns out that people that have a BMI of 26, if they're older, they tend to live longer than people that have lower BMI, right? So that already tells you that it's not as easy as we think, right? 26 is actually overweight. So the overweight earlier is not good, right? It's associated with cancer or diabetes, Alzheimer's, et cetera, et cetera. But the overweight, the slightly overweight in the 70, 80, 90 year olds, they do better than the people that have lower weight. And even if they're in a healthy, not sort of like anorexic state. So it's tricky. And I think that's the people like me, the focus on making people live healthy and long, have to keep this in mind. And that's why we say, yeah, don't go down to less than 12, 13% body fat. Not a good idea. Really pushing your luck.
Do you think that the Mediterranean lifestyle with plenty, I mean, you're Mediterranean, so am I. For us, possibly the normal thing is to eat lots of plants, lots of seeds, lots of olive oil. I just came back not even 2 weeks ago from Barcelona, and the restaurants, the food is fresher. It has abundance of veggies on the plate. Do you think that that lifestyle is what you are promoting in your book, but more for longevity, and or is completely different?
First of all, the Mediterranean, I think we should stop like using the word Mediterranean diet. You know, this is, I'm somebody from Italy, right? So I shouldn't say that. They may take my citizenship away, but you know, it just caused a lot of confusion, because all the Italians and the Spanish and the Greeks, they think they're doing the Mediterranean diet because they think everything they do is Mediterranean. And so I think it's done a lot of damage, right? And now, because we went away from what is it exactly that it's good to eat, to like, it's Mediterranean, it must be good. You know, so whenever I go to, I mean, Italy, they have a terrible diet, right? And so do the Spanish people. Meaning terrible in the sense it's much more, it's more and more westernized, more and more proteins, more and more animal meats, et cetera, et cetera. And so then there is a portion of the old Mediterranean diet, you know, with like my grandpa.
What was it like, the traditional, what people ate in the 1700s?
Well, I mean, not the 1700s, but let's say, you know, like say after the war, maybe during the war and before the war. I mean, lots of these centenarians that I just go around the world, talk to centenarians, and a lot of them will say, well, we had nothing, you know? So what did we have? Well, we had green beans. We had lots of legumes that we grew in the backyard. And then maybe on Sunday, we had some pig meat, right? Some pork meat. And we were very careful. And that could last us the entire year, you know, to just have a pig, one slaughtered pig, last your entire year. And that's all you had, right? So lots of things they were able to grow in their backyard, and then just very little meat. And sometimes if they had cheese, if they're wealthy enough and they had some cheeses, like Sardinians had ricotta, they have a little bit of that or a lot of that. But most people were just loaded with vegetables, some fruit, lots of vegetables, and very little meat, right? And the longevity diet that I described is much more that, right? So to be clear. But it's also, as I mentioned earlier, there's age-specific effects, right? So somebody I think that somebody that is younger than 18, 19, 20 should be on a Mediterranean diet. And somebody that is older than 70 should be on a Mediterranean diet. So Mediterranean diet is more like variety of food, the cheeses, the yogurts, the meats are fine, the white meats are fine. But the 20 to 70 group probably should be on a longevity diet, which is much more restrictive, much more based on the science, and much more personalized. And it's not, you know, you don't need a manual to do it, but you need to know what you're doing. And so I think it's good to talk to somebody that specializes in it.
So would somebody like myself, that I'm not familiar with the longevity diet, be able to just grab your book and create a plan for me? I hate the word diet. I just don't like it. Personally, I think it's a word that should disappear from our vocabulary because it's more lifestyle. So 20 to 70, we should have a lifestyle that is that mimics your longevity plan. So what is that longevity plan? Somebody like me, I'm 49 years old. I'm in healthy weight. I am physically active. What should I eat?
Yeah, well, first of all, diet is a scientific term that we use to describe everything that's an animal or a person eats, right? It's not about losing weight. It has nothing to do with losing weight. So the longevity diet, my book, is about what do people eat, and it's based on all these different pillars, or what I call five pillars of longevity. Yeah, so I think that it is high legumes, right? So like beans and chickpeas and peas and lentils, and then maybe two or three times a week fish, watching for high mercury fish, so the tunas, the swordfish, etc. I mean, you should learn which one have lots of mercury and try to maybe do it once a month. That's it. Yeah. So tuna once a month. Then you have to have the ones that have omega-3, omega-6s. So the salmons, maybe once or twice a week. And then whole grains, right? So trying to have as much organic. I know it's more expensive, but try to move as much as possible to whole grains that are as organic as possible. And then, you know, almonds, walnuts, hazelnuts, not too much. A lot of people can develop allergies and intolerance to them, right? So you have to be careful. And I also always say, look at among these, it's not really the foods that I described, it's the category of foods that I described. So if you look at your grandparents and your great-grandparents, or you can ask, even if you don't know what they used to eat, right? So go back to those foods, right? So I always say, you know, quinoa, the world is going crazy for quinoa. But quinoa comes from South America. And so some from towns and grandparents and great-grandparents, they were used to eating quinoa. The rest of the world is not used to it. That's why it could be that quinoa does nothing to you. It could be that it makes you intolerant eventually, right? So like lactose, right? So if you're from Norway or Northern Europe, you're almost never going to be lactose intolerant. But if you're from Sicily or Japan, you're almost for sure going to be lactose intolerant, right? So if you ask your grandparents, they will have told you in Norway, yeah, I used to have milk all the time, even as a 50-year-old. But if you ask your grandparents in Japan, they will have said, no, we never had milk as 50-year-old. Nobody did, right? Because we knew it would hurt us, right? Yeah, so then I will just use the categories that I described and then look into the history of your family. It might not be always easy, but and try to find the foods that were very common at the table of your grandparents.
Very interesting. And, you know, I feel about what I was mentioning about the word diet, the same way you feel about the word or the term Mediterranean lifestyle or diet. When people think of diet, it's a period. I start and I end. A lot of people, before they start the diet, they binge the day before because they think, well, tomorrow I start the diet. And I think that the whole concept has such a negative impact on people's beliefs that they think, oh, okay, well, I'm going to try the longevity diet. I'm going to try the mimicking and I'm going to try. And it's not adopted as a lifestyle. But what you're promoting truly is to adopt a lifestyle of a plant-based, not necessarily vegan or vegetarian, but rich in plants lifestyle with some proteins and with some seeds and with carbohydrates are from good sources, right?
Yeah. Yeah, with the whole grain and greens and fruits. So good sources of carbohydrates.
Now, let me ask you about the mimicking diet. How do you do it? Because I've been reading, you know, the calories that you can take. Can you explain us a little bit more in how does it act on the body? Because we have been very familiar the last 5 years or so with autophagy, fasting, allowing the body to, you know, to let mTOR rest. How does the mimicking diet, or does mimicking diet resemble that autophagy and health benefits? And if so, how do we do it?
Yeah, so the fasting mimicking diet will increase autophagy probably more than anything else out there because it lasts 5 days, right? So it puts the person in a fasting response mode for 5 days. So unless you check into a clinic, you know, that would be the only way to beat that. But besides checking into a clinic, if you're going to do it at home, that's about the most autophagy probably you're going to get, right? So yeah, but the idea, autophagy is a small part of the fasting response, right? And I always say, imagine taking a building. Imagine if you have an old city and you want to, or old neighborhood and you want to renew it. Taking the building down is autophagy, right? I mean, now you just have a lot of junk. Doesn't look any good at all, right? So yeah, the much better part, which we've been focusing on for many years, is the rebuilding, right? So what the fasting mimicking diet does is it shrinks organs. And in mice, we can actually demonstrate this. In people, I mean, it's harder to know the molecular details of what's happening, but we think it's the same. So in mice, so the organs shrink. And then at the end of the fasting mimicking diet, they shrink. And they start turning on stem cells. And they also start turning on what are called Yamanaka factor. So they are beginning to getting ready for, you know, regeneration, right? So the stem cells are turned on, they're sort of rewired. And then when the food comes back around, and so of course, autophagy is also part of that. And then when the food comes back around, that's the most important part. And that's where everything begins to be rebuilt. Yeah, and even in cancer, everything also includes immune cells. And we there was several papers that we published that the immune system gets also rejuvenated or somewhat rejuvenated. And so now it can be stronger against the cancer, right? So, yeah, so I think that there is a whole program that happens in those 5 days that, of which maybe, I always say, maybe autophagy is 20% of it.
In that mimicking stage, are we consuming calories and how many per day?
It depends who you are, right? So it depends if you're a cancer patient, a diabetes patient, or a normal person, right? So for a normal person, it's about 1,100 calories on day one and 800 calories on day 2, 3, 4, 5. For a cancer patient, then we instead now are doing 600 calories for 4 or 5 days. Those are the two methods that we're using. And I think, you know, people should really just focus on the things, on the fasting mimicking diet that are being clinically tested. They come in a box. And again, I don't make a penny out of any of this, but I really think that, you know, if you look at the standard that the FDA has, and this is why fasting and all these things have never moved into standard of care, right? They never got into the doctor's office or the nutritionist's office because they were improvised, right? The people go home and say, I want to do this, I want to do that. I think I understand this. But I think if it's standardized, and now let's say we've done 3 clinical trials on diabetes, right? So now we're getting close to the 500-600 patient numbers that are needed to become standard or somewhat standard. So I think that's what's needed. It's got to be standardized, got to be always the same. And we have to allow all kinds of hospitals around the world and universities to test it. And then they make their independent assessment of what it does. And then people should just do that, whether it's FDA approved or not, but at least it's being tested and proven to be effective or not. You
know? So 1,100 calories the first day, then 800 calories, and it remains 800 for 5 days, or it goes lower?
No, it remains the same for 5 days for normal subjects, for normal people. For all other, you know, for Alzheimer's, it's higher calories, right? So for cancer is much lower calories. And then we have, diabetes is a different composition, and autoimmunity is a completely different content.
I know you don't make any profits from it, but are there companies that will provide the food? Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, I mean, there are companies all over the world. There is a company all over the world. I cannot talk about products, but yeah, I mean, it's very easy to find if you put fasting mimicking diet, then you find the company that works on it.
Excellent. Do you have concerns about losing muscle when perhaps not on the 1100 calorie day, but when you go down to 800 muscle loss, what have you seen?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, right? Because we've done four clinical trials and none of them are showing any lean body mass and muscle loss in humans, right? And in the mice, we also looked at bone density, and actually old mice that were on cycles of the fasting mimicking diet twice a month had a higher bone density compared to those on the control diet. So now in four different human trials, we see no loss of lean body mass. So I think it's pretty conclusive. And now we also seen evidence, at least in mice, for effects on bone density. And so I think that's very good. For example, we've done a trial where we did 4 months of the Mediterranean diet. And after 4 months of the Mediterranean diet, the people in the trial had lost an average of 3 pounds. And then after 7 months, the loss was 5 pounds of muscle mass. So I think, again, it's that science is really important. Some of the things are counterintuitive. And so that's why it's so important to have the consistent randomized trial data.
Professor, for a patient with cancer, would the fasting mimicking diet help with apoptosis?
Well, it helps with apoptosis and a lot more than apoptosis, right? So it lowers IGF-1, it lowers glucose, it lowers insulin. And so it makes it very hard for the cancer cells to stay alive. Now, this has been shown in many, many different mouse studies, but now we're starting to be clear also for the human studies. And the other thing that it does is apoptosis related is make the immune cell attack more effectively the cancer cells, right? So the T cells are now turning against the cancer and they're forcing the apoptosis or certainly the cell death. So I think that the just fundamental properties of fasting and fasting mimicking diets in just making it very difficult only for the cancer cells, right? Because cancer cells are rebels, and that's why I always use the desert analogy. If you haven't heard it before, basically I said, can you imagine putting 1 billion people in the desert and having 1 billion with no water, no shade, and make him run, right? So this is what happens to cancer cells. They cannot stop running, so they keep running. So you take away the water, and this would be the fasting, and then you put them under the sun, and this would be the chemo, the immunotherapy, etc. And so if you left people in the desert with no water and no shade under the sun running, after a couple of weeks, there'd be nobody alive, right? And but if you give them water and you put them in the shade and you make them sit, they'll all be alive, right? So this is the difference that this intervention can cause, right? You can go from, and that's what we see sometimes, from all alive to all dead, but only the cancer cells, the normal cells are nearly all alive. Yeah.
What do you think that starts cancer? What's the first? I mean, we know that the World Health Organization has told us only about 5% of cancers are genetic. So that leaves us with 95 out of every 100 people that develop cancer. Where does it come from?
So we've been following these little people in Ecuador that don't have the growth hormone receptor, and they almost never get cancer. And the mice that have the same mutation, they almost never get cancer. And not surprisingly, that happens to be the growth gene that responds to high animal protein levels, right? So now we have a genetic demonstration that, lots of these cancers are, and this was similarly shown in Israel and in Europe with the people that have the same mutation. I think that probably a combination of bad diet, pollutants, and then, genetic predisposition, right? So yeah, if you You may not get cancer with the genetic predisposition alone, but if you're now exposed to a lot of pollutants and a bad diet, now you may be that may be the what you need to develop a certain type of cancer.
You mentioned IGF-1, the growth hormone factor. We need it, but why does it have plays a role with cancer?
Well, number one, because it accelerates aging, right? So every indication is the growth hormone, insulin, IGF-1, this what's called axis. It seems to be pushing the body to grow, 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 reproduce, reproduce. And this seems to be at the center of aging. I think most of the aging researchers will agree with that, right? Then it promotes cell division, right? And then it blocks cell death, right? Apoptosis, right? So for all these reasons together, that's why it's probably so central. And again, the little people of Ecuador have almost no IGF-1 at all. They don't have any problems, and they rarely have cancer, right? So that's same thing for the little mice, right? The growth hormone receptor deficient, they don't get they get a lot less cancer, and they have almost no IGF-1 at all. So yeah, so I think that now we're getting closer to the proof that these growth factors and genes are at the center of cancer development. And again, not surprisingly, they're connected to proteins and amino acids.
So these insulin growth factor, all related to insulin, would you propose is that we can control it? So the people in Ecuador, I think you're referring to a study that I read a few years ago. They were people that didn't grow. They were little people, very small people. And genetically, none of them, they studied them because of, they didn't develop cancer. And genetically, they found that they lacked the IGF-1. They didn't have that. But what you're proposing is that we can control it. At what age should we start controlling it? Because certainly, if we don't want to be little people, we don't want little kids to not have enough growth hormone. So where is the sweet spot that a person should start controlling what stimulates it, which you said it's protein consumption, animal protein?
Yeah, this is why we say maybe 20, age 20, so somebody's fully developed, normal size. Probably the effects are not going to be as strong as if somebody started earlier, right? So then we suspect that being born with it is more powerful than starting at age 20. But we also know that if you change your diet at age 20 to what I described earlier, the life expectancy goes up up to 13 years. If you start at 60, it's 8 to 9 years, or up to 8, 9 years. If you start at 80, it's 3 to 4 years, right? So if you start at 20, I think controlling the growth pathways, that could have a big effect. And together with the diet, we suspect that if you put it all together, we're looking probably at 20 years of life expectancy difference, but maybe 30 or 40 years of health span difference, meaning that the period of life where the person is sick with one or two or three or four chronic diseases, we may see in people starting to do all the right things at age 20, we may see maybe over 30 years of difference. I give you my own example. I mean, I think it was about 30. I have hypertension in the family, high cholesterol in the family, and I had both. I had started developing hypertension at 30 and high cholesterol. And so luckily, I was a student of Roy Walford at UCLA, and Roy was already preaching these extreme diets, maybe more extreme than I'm preaching. And so this is where I started working on the longevity diet. And you know, I never taken statins. I never taken any drugs either for cholesterol or blood pressure, and both of them are normal. So yeah, so I think that people should start early, and not just with thinking about the growth hormone and IGF-1 and insulin, but thinking about the entire diet and probably being followed by somebody that knows what they're doing.
What is your opinion on alcohol and longevity?
Yeah, this has always been a fight now for the past 5 years between me and lots of different people. I think the data, lots of data, like meta-analysis, studies of all studies, suggest that overall, if you drink less than 4 drinks a week, it's not going to make any difference, right? In fact, there's argument that it may slightly benefit overall, right? Now there's lots of cancers for which, you know, even the four drinks a week may be a risk factor, right? If you have one of those, then I think throat is one of them and a few more. Breast cancer is minimal, but it's also in there. If you're everybody in the family was getting one, and those are listed in my new book on cancer and also in my old book, I think, The Longevity Diet. And so if you have some of those if you have something in the family that already puts you at risk for some of these cancers, I would not add the alcohol to it, you know, even the four glasses. Otherwise, I think it's such a pleasure for you know, the world that the last thing we need to do is take it away from the general population that doesn't have the risk factors for those, especially because, again, as there's no evidence that will make you live any shorter.
Do you think that we, as people that maybe know, but really don't know, because the more you know, the more we realize how much there is left to be learned and how much things change as we discover new things. But do you think that we perhaps sin on the side of perfectionism in science? Everybody is looking for that perfect recipe of, you can't, it's so strict to the point that it affects the emotional well-being of the patient. I mean, I'm going to ask you about what your pillars of health are. I'm interested in knowing what yours are. But in my opinion, I think that one of the pillars is emotional well-being. And part of emotional well-being is being with friends, having a drink, laughing, relaxing. And that doesn't mean that you cannot do it without alcohol. You can as well. But if having a little bit of alcohol helps somebody ease up and just relax, in my opinion, and I want to ask what your opinion is, I feel that the benefit of that emotional well-being will be equal to the harm that it can make. So pretty much it's an even result. What's your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, more than my opinion, this is the data, right? The data shows that eventually you're going to live the same if you drink less than four drinks a week than if you don't, right? So they say overall, if you look at all diseases, cardiovascular and cancer and immunity, you know, if you drink, if you drink 15 drinks a week, clearly you're going to have a shorter lifespan, right? And lots of diseases. But let's say if you have a glass every other day, there is absolutely no evidence, unless you have those risk factors, that overall this is going to hurt you. And this is the first, what you just said is absolutely right. And it's essential, because at the clinics that we have, the foundation clinics, the first rule is we never give a manual. We never go to the patient and say, here's what you do. We always say, what do you like to do, right? What makes you happy? And then listen and then say, okay, you're eating five steaks a week. Can you go to zero? And the patient might say, absolutely not. Okay, can you go to one? Right? So, yeah. So, and also the approach of the dietitian and nutritionist is like, what are these changes? If you made them, you'd be still happy and you could keep for the rest of your life. And then you get a good sense. And this is why it usually takes us 2 to 3 years to convert people, right? 2 to 3 years of working with them and just finding out. And then eventually people say, okay, this is like, I'm happy now. And, you know, I'm having this and that and I'm having the effects, right? And then for those that don't, we have the fasting mimicking diet. And we preach the fasting mimicking diet only maybe once every 4 months, right? So there's some people say, you know what? I don't want to make any changes, right? Zero. Then if you don't want to make any changes, and we published this on mice a few years ago in a paper in Nature Metabolism, we basically took mice and we gave them high fat, high calorie, high sugar diet. And it became huge. And then we gave them the same diet, but once a month, we gave them 5 days of the fasting mimicking diet. And just the 5 days a month, we're able to completely reverse all the problems caused by the bad diet, right? Cholesterol, heart damage, mortality, you know, lifespan, fasting glucose, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so I think that's our approach, right? Yeah, can you make lots of changes? You should. But for maybe the 50% of the population that is absolutely never going to make any changes, And look at smoking, right? When the world learned that smoking was going to kill you, only about half of the people that were smoking quit. And I mean, I don't think anybody had any doubt that has any doubt that smoking is bad for you. But yet, half of the people stuck with it. And that's why I think that, you know, we need to be smarter than just say you need to change what you eat. Maybe you don't need to change. You won't change what you eat. And then we have maybe another solution that is not necessarily loading you up with drugs.
I like that. And I like the fact that you evaluate the fact that humans are humans. We are people. We're not machines. And compliance sometimes is not easy. I find that with exercise and with people that talk about being physically active, and they have these goals that you have to do so many minutes, you know, every day. And some people just don't have an hour a day. Some people just don't have. So my theory is just do small capsules. If you're doing nothing right now, if you're doing absolutely nothing, I prohibit you from starting with 30 minutes. I want you to start with five. Start just with five. You cannot do 30. And it'd be surprising how these people go like only five. And this patient does five, gets used to five, and this goes to six and to 10 and to 15. And then they get to 20 minutes a day easily to something that is healthy. But I feel that sometimes we're such perfectionists in the scientific world. And I include myself, and I've corrected myself so many times over the years, that we want this box, that the patient becomes the inside of the box. So I really love the fact that you have developed something that can help people start seeing the difference. Because I think that, have you found that when the patient starts feeling a little bit better, is more motivated to do more? That perhaps the lack of motivation is that you just don't feel good about it, so you don't want to change anything.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where the FMD comes in, right? The fasting mimicking diet will have such a drastic effect on the person within 2 or 3 days. And that's what gets them, you know, involved. And so we really want to go after the aging process, right? But yet a lot of people want to go after the weight and feeling better, and they get it very rapidly. Yeah, absolutely. I agree that it should be really a process, and the patient should be honest and say, look, I can't do what you're saying. But also, I think we work on making it easy. And so, for example, with exercise, I talk about, you know, one thing is to say go running and or go biking. Or one thing is to say spend $200 or maybe less. You can even get $100 used. I buy one of the bikes that have high resistance. And I mean, three places in the world that I spend a lot of time, Milan, Genova, and Los Angeles. And I have one in each place, right? Because I basically, if you ask me to go running, I would never do it. But now I do 1 hour every other day of these bikes. And that to me is just religion, right? And it's very straightforward, very easy. It's right in my home. I don't have excuses. I can do meetings. I can do whatever I need to do. You can do it at any time of the day. And yeah, so I think things like that make a big difference rather than say, yeah, you have to go to the gym or you have to go and do something that is complicated because it's too hot, it's too cold, there's too much traffic or whatever. So we really see that makes a big difference for people. Make it simple to exercise. And make it inexpensive and simple and at home.
Yes, I agree. And the reality is that if we don't develop the discipline to exercise at home, we will spend a lot of money on a gym that we'll never use because we haven't developed the discipline. So start at home. And once you develop the discipline, if it makes you feel better to go to the gym, then go to the gym. It's equally well. But we have to slowly develop that habit. To close up, what does Professor Longo eat in a day? What's your day like?
I start with almond spread, chocolate almond spread. There's mostly almonds and chocolate and nothing else. And a whole grain, what we call frisella in Italy. It's a very hard piece of bread that comes from a particular area of southern Italy. And then I have an apple and tea. And I actually mix one bag of green tea and one of black tea. And that's every morning. And then I usually, Monday to Friday, I have basically a coffee for lunch with sugar. I like to point that out.
A lot of sugar or little sugar?
No, not a lot of sugar, just like a small teaspoon, yeah. And then Friday and Saturday, I mean, Saturday and Sunday, I actually have lunch, right? So I thought it was important, actually, to me and to a lot of patients that we follow, works very well, meaning that you learn how to not have lunch. And then after, it takes a couple of months. After a couple of months, you don't care whether you have it or not. But having lunch on Saturday and Sunday to us, and we're now testing this in Southern Italy in a large clinical trial with 500 patients, that eventually having this trains your brain to either have it or not have it, right? But the majority is not have it. So you're perfectly fine not having it. But, you know, if you want to be social on Saturday or Sunday, then you can have it and it doesn't bother you. Sometimes, you know, whenever I have it on Saturday and Sunday, I don't feel like I have dinner because I feel full by the time I get to dinner, right? So this is my lunch. And then dinner, I usually, my typical dish is lots of legumes, like say 300 grams or 350 grams of legumes, like chickpeas, let's say. And then maybe another 300 grams of mixed vegetables, green beans and carrots, et cetera, et cetera. And then lots of olive oil. And then pasta, maybe usually 70 to 80 grams of pasta. And then, you know, I may also have bread, which I know there's a lot of dietitians are very concerned. But, you know, I think that's fine. My fasting glucose is low. Even if I have pasta and bread, I may have a little spike, but A1C actually stays very low, below 5. Even having, you know, fairly high carbohydrate and starch level. I mean, not a very high, but certainly I don't avoid starches and I don't avoid carbs. Yeah, so I think in most of the patients we follow, we give them something very, very similar. And this is basically the longevity diet.
Very nice. Very palatable for all of those that are listening, especially if they can get a hand on that bread from that specific location in Italy. Next time I go to Europe, I'm going to have to go there and find some of it. Love hard bread. I love.
Yeah, by the way, I end with dark chocolate, 85% dark chocolate every night. It's another religious thing that I do. Yeah, so at the end of dinner, then I have dark chocolate.
Just to close up, would you agree that the perfect diet doesn't exist? It's so complex when we speak about nutrition and you voiced that at the beginning of the interview. It's so complex to answer what should we eat and so varied from person to person that to even cover that in this interview, it's nearly impossible. But do you think that perhaps we should be more relaxed with what people eat as long as it falls within the parameters that you've given them?
Yeah, of course. It matters what the parameters are, right? I mean, unfortunately, the world is moving exactly in the opposite direction, right? They're eating more, worse and worse and worse and more diseases. And yeah, so it's getting out of control, right? So I think if anything, we need to move back to the discipline that our grandfathers and great-grandfathers had, right? And maybe they had discipline because they couldn't afford it, but it doesn't matter. I think it works psychologically. And it works physically. And the illusion is that if you keep eating whatever you want, you're going to be happier. And that's not true at all. You know, and that's not going to make you happy. I think you're going to be happier if you feel good, if you eat the right amount. And yes, you should have flexibility. Nobody's saying that. Here's the, as I was saying earlier, we don't give manuals to any patient. We ask them, what do you like? Right. But then we say, if the patient says, you know, hey, I have 5 steaks a week. Well, that's what I said earlier. We say, can you go to 0, right? And if they say, no, I got to stay 5, then we're going to say, okay, you're going to need to do the fasting mimicking diet. Maybe once a month, right? If you're diabetic and you know, have lots of animal fats and proteins and you are insulin resistant, right? So I will argue that the perfect diet exists, but it's modified for every person. And but it doesn't take very long to get to it. Let's not say perfect. There's nothing perfect. Let's say semi-perfect, right? I mean, eventually we might find out that something makes it even better, right? But let's say the semi-perfect diet exists. It has to be modified for each person, for each person's psychology and brain and needs and the moment of life and et cetera, et cetera. And again, the number one goal should not be weight. It should be aging. It should be longevity. It should be health span. And weight is just a bonus.
Yeah, as I always say, is to be overweight is a side effect of not being healthy. It's not about aesthetics. If you're healthy, you're not necessarily skinny if you have a bigger bone set, but you're healthy looking. You're not looking overweight. So, Professor, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you for joining us all the way from Italy. I know it's a little bit later there. Thank you for all your insights. And hopefully one day when I'm in California or in Italy, we can meet you in person. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, please. My pleasure. Thank you. And yeah, come and visit him.
Thank you.